It's here at the miracle of the 1955 General Motors Motorama. Go on, enjoy yourself. Look around at the new dream cars built to test new ideas and your reactions to them. The way you look at this LaSalle second will help build tomorrow's cars. Perhaps you dream about a low, sleek car like the Biscayne. The way you look at it can put some of its features on cars of the future. The flair of a sports car may excite you, so you might go for the Stratostar. And there's room for the family to share the excitement in this six-passenger hardtop.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Horsepower Heritage. I'm Maurice Merrick. And greetings to all of you listening from far-flung places north, south, east, and west. If you're a new listener, thanks for checking out the show, and I hope it becomes your new favorite podcast. We love automotive history around here, and motorcycles too, by the way, so you'll hear about all sorts of different subjects, and you never know what might be coming next. Besides the podcast, there's also the YouTube channel with unique videos, and there's Instagram too. Lots of good stuff for you over there. So check out Horsepower Heritage on all of those platforms. I think you'll enjoy it. And if you do like what you hear, be sure to share Horsepower Heritage with your friends. All right, well, today we're turning back the clock to a time when the American car was still the king of the road. And General Motors led the way. In the 1950s, the GM Motorama captured the public's imagination with an annual traveling exhibition of dream cars. It was a showcase of GM's technological might and, quite literally, the shape of things to come. Because although these dream cars were never intended to be sold, many of their styling cues would eventually make their way into production cars. Millions of people saw the Motorama between 1953 and 1961 as it made its way across the country each year. Not to be outdone, other manufacturers like Chrysler, Ford, Packard, and American Motors had their own show cars, what we call concept cars today, and they forecast the unique visions of their makers. Now, the one thing that all these manufacturers had in common was that once the show was over, the cars were supposed to be destroyed, and many were. But luckily, a number were also spared that fate through the foresight of designers, engineers, and managers inside these companies. And my guest today became the ultimate savior of some of these cars. Joe Bortz caught the car bug while growing up in the northern suburbs of Chicago, Illinois. Eventually, he began collecting cars, and gradually his focus fell on saving as many of these dream cars as he could. And now the Peterson Museum in Los Angeles is giving everyone a golden opportunity to see them up close. GM's marvelous Motorama, Dream Cars from the Joe Bortz Collection, opens this Saturday, March 16th. Joe has shown his cars regularly over the years, but to have so many displayed together as only the Peterson Museum can do is very exciting. And it's the closest we'll ever get to attending the Motorama ourselves. So naturally, I had to talk to Joe about the cars and how he found them and restored them and why they're so important. Now, if you go to the Horsepower Heritage Instagram page, you'll see many of the cars in Joe's collection. And trust me, you need to see them for yourself. It's very difficult to describe them. Before we get started, I want to mention, if you enjoy the podcast, go to buymeacoffee.com/HB Heritage and become a patron of the show. For as little as $2, you can support my work and help keep these great stories and interviews coming. I've got some really exciting stuff in the works, some of which involves a little bit of travel, and that's because I like to do these interviews in person whenever possible. So when you become a patron, you're directly contributing to that effort. Again, that's buymeacoffee.com/HP Heritage. All right, get ready to go back to the fabulous 50s. I've got dream cars from the Joe Bortz collection, and that's coming up right after this. This episode of Horsepower Heritage is sponsored by Model Citizen Diecast. No matter what's in your garage, you can fit all your automotive heroes on a shelf. And they've got you covered, whether it's 1/43 scale, 1/18 scale, or even the ginormous 1/8 scale masterpieces from the Amalgam Collection. Go to modelcitizendiecast.com and get 10% off when you use the promo code HERITAGE at checkout. Limitations apply. From race cars to street cars and everything in between, it's Model Citizen Diecast, because your inner child still wants to play with cars. Do you remember the first car that just really knocked your socks off and made you interested in this stuff?
Well, going back to ancient history, I can tell you that as a young kid at the age 3, 4, 5, the toys that I played with were always cars. And I used to think that was a unique story, but then when I heard the story of other car collectors, I found out that they kind of had that same symptom as kids. Instead of playing with other kinds of toys, they were playing with cars and sometimes trains or airplanes. Transportation seemed to catch their fancy. And for me, it was cars. And car dealers used to have a big deal every year about the new model. And they used to take their store windows and paper them up, put a little hole in it, and then you could go over there and kind of try and peek in there to see the new cars that were going to come out the next year. You'd get an early view of them. So I used to go into the car dealers, and of course, this is before television, before computers, and they would have a rack of brochures of the cars, but not just the cars, but they'd have the automatic transmission, oh, we got new power steering, and all the other features. They'd have an individual brochure. So I used to go into the dealers and pull out all those brochures and take them home. And eventually, the car dealers got to know me, and at the end of the year, they would have boxes of unopened literature from that current year that they were going to throw out because they had the new cars coming in with new literature. So they said, hey, Joe, if you want this, you can have these unopened boxes. So I talked my dad into getting me a newspaper delivery bike that had this huge basket on the front and a little, it was a Schwinn, and had a little 16-inch wheel on the front. So you could have this big basket. And at the end of the year, I'd go around to all the dealers and I would collect literally unopened boxes of car literature. And in my bedroom, I had a closet that was about 16 feet long and about 5 feet wide. And I started piling up this literature in there. And when I was 13, my mother sent me to camp up in Wisconsin. She said, oh, by the way, we're remodeling the kitchen and we're putting in new cabinets and we're getting rid of the pantry and all that kind of stuff. And what she didn't tell me was that when I got home, that they expanded the kitchen into my closet. And my closet was gone. So, of course, my immediate reaction to my mother was, what happened to all my car literature, which was literally, I mean, thousands and thousands of pieces by that time. She says, oh, that stuff was a fire hazard. We had to throw it out.
Oh, no.
Yeah. You know, so that's the kind of thing. But at that point, you know, I was born in 41. And, you know, by 51, 52, General Motors was the cars of the future. And Harley Earl, and he came up with the Motorama. And the Motorama, at that time, it was safe to travel around in the city as a kid. And we would get on a streetcar and take a streetcar and then a bus to the International Amphitheater to see the car show. But the main part of the car show was General Motors Motorama, and they'd have a little stage show, but the stage wasn't up too high. It might have been 2 feet high. And so the crowd would literally block the show, and I would have to tap some guy, you know, on the show, hey, can I crawl up on your shoulders to watch the show? And so this is where I got indoctrinated with General Motors cars. And they would have singing and dancing, and then they'd bring out, you know, the production cars. And in the end, they'd usually bring out the dream cars, concept cars. There was not a word called concept cars back then. It was dream cars, and that was coined by Harley Earl. And, of course, as he made these dream cars, cars of the future, served a lot of different purposes. One of them was to make everybody come to his section in the shows that had all the different makes there. And it also made General Motors look like they were the cars of the future. And my dream was to be just in the front one day where I could be, nobody was blocking the cars, I'd be in the front. But never did I have an idea I could touch one or sit in one or own. I mean, that was like me imagining I could be a ballerina. You know, I mean, it just was not in my mind. So that was where my focus really became on concept cars and dream cars.
Joe, you mentioned Harley Earl, and we should really kind of set the table. He is arguably the single most important designer in General Motors history because he's the guy who came up with the concept of yearly model changes, and he established styling, automotive styling.
Yeah. I think, first of all, to understand his history, that his family, I guess they had a dealership, as best I recall. Maybe it was a Cadillac dealership. And Harley Earl ended up designing special bodies for the movie stars to put on standard cars, you know, so that they'd have something different, something that would catch the attention. And in 1927, General Motors found Harley Earl, and they hired him to come in and be the head stylist. And they actually made a styling department. Most manufacturers didn't have a styling department. They just had designers. And the designers, at that point, the locomotive for cars was not the stylists, but it was the engineers. So in other words, the engineers would engineer the chassis, the car, and then the stylists had to design the style around whatever the dimensions were that were given by the engineers. And Harley Earl really reversed that process in the long run. And interestingly enough, his very first car that he designed for General Motors was a 1927 LaSalle, and he stylized that, and it was a big hit. And from that, he kind of grew up in General Motors and became either the most important person there or, you know, one of two or three of the most important people.
And they called it the Art and Color Department.
Originally, it was the Art and Color Department. Exactly. I was trying to think of that and didn't recall. Now, here's an important factor about Harley Earl. Not one person can show you a drawing, a sketch of Harley Earl's, not even on a napkin. Nobody can show you something that Harley Earl drew with his hands. So I call Harley Earl kind of an orchestra leader that didn't play any instruments. And just to throw it in, that differentiates Harley Earl from Virgil Exner, because Virgil Exner was kind of like the one-man band with a harmonica tied to his mouth, and cymbals under his arms, and some clankers on his knees, a one-man band that played everything. Virgil Exner would make the clay designs. He'd make them himself. He had people working under him, but he really could do any one of those particular arts himself. Harry Earl came up with the idea of having different rooms for different divisions and putting in stylists that they brought up from their art guild thing where they'd have contests for young designers. And they put them in a room, five, six guys in there. And you say, okay, I need a new rear end for the Cadillac and I want it to have some fins. And that would be it. They'd sit there and they'd draw. He'd come in every day. He'd look at, nope, that's not it. Nope. Oh, I like that, but modify this. And that's how they would start to get going on a particular final design. I've actually talked to designers, and they'd say, you know, I was in Oldsmobile, and I was just finishing up a design on Friday. On Monday, I came in, and all my designs were gone. I didn't know what happened. And I was afraid Harley Earl would get mad at me, think I did something with the designs. Harley Earl came in, and he sheepishly said to Harley Earl, I don't know what happened to the designs of the Oldsmobile. He says, no, I took those off your board. I put them in Pontiac. I thought they looked better at Pontiac. You know, so that's how things went there, you know.
It's very interesting. And regular listeners to the podcast will have heard something about Virgil Exner before, because I did an entire episode on Exner. But in case you didn't know, Exner worked at Studebaker after World War II and then went to Chrysler, and he's the guy that's really responsible for the growth of the tail fin craze, and actually did wind tunnel testing. He was convinced that tail fins were a stabilizing factor in car design. A lot of his stuff is very outlandish, even compared to, like, what we think of as the chrome excess of the Harley Earl, the late Harley Earl years. But anyway, Exner, a fascinating character, and yes, could design by his own hand and did frequently.
Unquestionably. And the story goes from General Motors in 1956. They had already gotten into the excesses of design at General Motors with too much chrome and things like that, too, you know, and they had heard that Exner was coming out with this phenomenal designs, but they couldn't get anything to see because it was really kept tight in the design department at Chrysler. And Dave Holes, who was, you know, one of the main designers there, he said that they heard that the production cars were starting to come out of the factory. So they went over to the yard where they would start to stack the finished cars, and they went over with a station wagon or something, and they stood on the roof to look over the fence. And he said when he saw those designs of the 57 Chryslers or Dodges, whatever it was, he said they all crapped in their pants. They knew they were in big trouble. Those designs were so far superior to what they had for 57 that they just didn't know what to do. And so that was his first viewing of the finished product of Exner. So certainly, you know, everything in design is evolutionary. The important thing to think with Harley Earl is he was the starter of the whole thing. And what started it really was World War II. World War II was the Americans felt that they won the war. And they did. And they got this attitude, if you got it, flaunt it. Well, if you're going to flaunt it, it's hard to flaunt engineering pieces that are all hidden under the car. So design became the most important thing. And Harley Earl was right there to take advantage of that. And that's how I think it all got started, with design being the locomotive rather than engineering.
By the way, I've heard that story before of them peeking over the fence. And I don't know whether it's true or not, but I want to believe it. It's a good story.
I absolutely believe it's true. When I heard it from Dave Holes, was a great fan of the Bortz Auto Collection. And his definition of the Bortz Auto Collection was, Joe Bortz did what General Motors should have been doing, saving all their great artwork. And Joe Bortz went and did it with his own money at no expense to General Motors. And Dave Holes used to invite me anywhere from 2 to 4 times a year to come to the tech center. And I think he kind of set this up. He would announce over the PA system that went through the whole tech center, Joe Bortz is coming. He's the guy that saved all these General Motors concept cars. And I want you to come out of your office and shake his hand. So when I would come there just to get lunch with him, I'd walk in the building and I'd hear over the PA system, Joe Bortz is in the building. You know, like I felt like Elvis Presley, you know. And then guys would come out of their office, oh, Joe, thank. And I knew that he had set that up. I mean, they wouldn't do that on their own. You know, he said, you better come out there and do what I tell you. And so, you know, so it was quite an experience. And, you know, he was just the biggest supporter of everything I did. I'll just give you a little footnote to that. We were going to go get lunch on the up on the top floor of the lunchroom. And he says, well, I'll take you into the clay room. I'll show you the new Cadillac. I don't remember what year it was. And it was a Cadillac. It was all in clay. And we walked around it. And it was pretty much finished. He said, what do you think of that? I said, well, I like it. It's really good and this and that. So anything you think is you know, not just right? I said, well, the only thing I thought was the taillights were a little small for the size of this car. Said, oh, okay. And then we went and we had lunch. And then, I don't know, maybe it was 2 years later, I get a brochure in the mail and a sticky note on it. And all it said was, Joe, what do you think of this? I didn't know. So I called, yeah, it was from Dave. Call him up. I said, yeah, I like the color. It's a nice color they put on their car. No. What do you think of the back end? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, take a look at the back end. Well, I looked at the back end. I realized that was the car we had looked at 2 years or 3 years before. And I looked at the taillights. I said, oh, the taillights are a lot bigger. He says, those are your taillights, Joe. You designed those taillights, you know. So that's the kind of guys that they were. They was always having fun with what they were doing, you know. They were car guys, yeah. You know. They were just, you know, 100% car guys.
Joe, your collection includes a lot of GM cars, some Chryslers, but we're also going to talk about some of the guys behind these designs. Guys like Chuck Jordan and Bill Mitchell and Brooks Stevens, another one. But the collection was built over decades, right, Joe? And in the meantime, you grew up, you had to make a living. Where did your career take you?
Well, I mean, initially I was a biochemist, and the family, we had a company, and the company eventually got sold and went to a large company on the New York Stock Exchange. We became part of that situation. And I always liked ice cream. And there was an ice cream parlor in Chicago called Dr. Jazz Ice Cream Parlor. And I used to go there about once a week. And the reason I went there wasn't just for the ice cream. It was filled with Nickelodeons and violin machines and penny arcade stuff. And I was a pretty regular customer. And the guy that had it originally had an antique store. And then he just developed it into an ice cream parlor because he liked all the stuff that was, like I say, Nickelodeons, violin machines, penny arcade stuff. And he kind of built this ice cream parlor. And one day he sat down next to me and he says, you know, Joe, he says, I just can't put up with the people and everything. He says, I want to sell this place. I said, his name was George. I says, oh, okay, George. He says, I want you to buy it. I says, oh, I'm a pharmaceutical chemist and I know anything about the retail business. And he said, well, I thought you would be interested. I said, no, I really not. I said, but out of curiosity, how much do you want for it? And he told me the price. I said, George, that's ridiculous. I said, that Nickelodeon over there is worth more than that price right there. He said, that's why I know you're going to buy it. So I ended up buying it. And I had a fellow who was working for me at the pharmaceutical plant. And I said, his name was Alan. I said, Alan, we're going to go partners here. And you're going to get off on Fridays at noon. And you're going to go over to the ice cream parlor. You're going to open it up Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Anyhow, long story short, it became very successful. And from that, we opened up some what was known at that time called pizza and pipe organ places. And we restored some old pipe organs out of silent movie theaters. And then we opened them up and we had roller skating host and hostesses, and it just went crazy. And so that was kind of like a thing. And eventually I got out of the pharmaceutical end and I became a restaurateur. Then eventually that led us into a concept of the nightclub business called Blue Suede Shoes. That was just a way of having a job and working and really enjoying it because it was very creative. Sure. It was very creative.
Hi guys, Maurice Merrick here. April is Parkinson's Awareness Month, and my friends at Drive Toward a Cure have planned a very special event to support Parkinson's research and patient care. An evening of music and motion will be held at the National Automobile Museum in Reno, Nevada on Thursday, April 18th. The event will feature prominent cars owned by performing artists, as well as cars driven by legendary racers who were challenged by Parkinson's disease. Legends like Phil Hill and his C-Type Jaguar. Special guests at an evening of music in motion include singer, actress, and producer Vanessa Williams, Rashida Ali, daughter of heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali, and Shelby Hall, granddaughter of the legendary Baja racer Rod Hall. It promises to be an evening to remember, with cars, music, and more. The event is just around the corner, April 18th, so get your tickets or make a contribution at drivetowardacure.org. Just click the link in the show notes. That's drivetowardacure.org, supporting Parkinson's research and patient care. Joe, let's talk about the collection. Most collectors have a theme or a focus, and yours is very interesting because it is, as you say, these dream cars, what we call today concept cars. But most of these cars were intended for the crusher. They were never meant to survive the exhibition halls and so forth.
Well, I started collecting cars when I was 16. My first car was a 50 Oldsmobile bubble top coupe. And I think even before that, I collected a 1928. Yeah, my first car was a 1928 Chevy padded top Landau coupe that wasn't running. And we pulled it home. It was about 80 miles away. We pulled it home with my dad's 1960 Corvair and a 50-foot rope. And we were pulling that car at 50 miles an hour. We only had had rear wheel brakes and everything. And today, if you tried something like that, they probably put you in jail for at least overnight, if not a couple days. But we did that. So it wasn't that I all of a sudden one day just jumped into concept cars. It was kind of, there was a whole progression before that, because I, like everybody else at that time in the 60s and the 70s, read all the books, and all the books said all these beautiful concept cars had crush orders on them before they were made. So I believe what I read in the books. So they were all crushed. And there was a few that General Motors kept, not too many. So one day, a friend of mine said to me, you know, Joe, I just talked to a guy, and he said he's got a concept car. And this my friend was named Mike. I said, Mike, don't be, foolish. They're all crushed. Read the books. I said, give me the phone number. I'll call the guy up. I'll find out. It's probably a customized car. And it was the 1960 Pontiac X400. And I called up the guy, and it turned out that he convinced me this was the 1960 show car for Pontiac, and that he was in the restaurant business, so we kind of bonded over it. He was a Greek guy, and he had a lot of restaurants. And I ended up with the car. And from that, I found out that these cars weren't all crushed, so I started searching for them and finding them out. And as I was finding them, Old Cars Weekly or whatever the publications were back then, Hemmings, would say, hey, Joe Bortz just found another concept car. And that started bringing out concept cars out of the woodwork. And the story became with the concept cars was that the designers that were making these concept cars were doing their finest work. This was not a commercial project. This was, hey, you do your finest work, your best sculpture that you can do. And they knew it was going to be crushed, and they accepted it in the beginning. But when it came time to crush it, they'd go to one of the executives, and they'd almost be crying, saying, is there some way I can save this car? And very often, a top executive would say, here's an order to take the car out of storage. You put it somewhere, and I don't want to hear about that car, know about that car for 25 years or until I'm dead. And at that time, so it was 25 years later, from the 50s, back in the early 80s, when all of a sudden people started coming to me, people who had got concept cars that were given to them or whatever. And they said, hey, I've had this car for 25 years and I don't know what to do with it. I'm getting old. Would you like to have it for your collection? And, of course. So that's how it kind of grew that way. And it wasn't that I had a design that now I'm going to go collect concept cars. Before concept cars, I was collecting Ferraris, some very rare Ferraris, and I was collecting classic cars, and I started collecting 50s cars, limited production cars like 53 Cadillac Eldorado, 53 Buick Skylark, 53 Oldsmobile Fiestas, and then as I started to realize that there were these more concept cars that people realize, in the beginning, it was really easy. I mean, they were just like falling out of the trees for me because nobody else realized they were around. So I was able to really be so early in the game that I could really get all the great ones. And then I got more than what I considered the great ones. And then I had to kind of pare things down to keep. I had all the great Virgil Exner cars, but I couldn't keep all those cars and all the GM cars. And I made finally the decision. I kept the best Virgil Exner car, the 1955 Chrysler Ghia Falcon, and the rest of them I gave up. And I kept all the GM stuff. I felt that the GM stuff was just a little closer to my heart. And that's how the collection has basically ended up.
Well, I think it's interesting that cars began to come to you. People realized you were really into the show cars and had been doing research, and you had a network established already.
Well, it was a snowballing effect that developed. You know, in the beginning, I was just a selfish car collector. And then people started to give me these accolades. Geez, you know, Joe, you're saving the history of General Motors. And then I rallied to that theme myself. And so it was a snowballing effect that started with just that selfish desire that, hey, I'm going to collect something I never thought I could collect. And then getting the accolades from people like Dave Holes that you rally to the theme, you know. So, yeah, it was a growing event. And it's been a wonderful trip. I'm not a young guy anymore. When I first started collecting, people would say, oh, that young college kid, how could he get this car? You know, I was lucky in the beginning getting certain really rare classic cars. And I remember, you know, people complaining, older guys at that time, yeah, you know, how that he goes around, people think he's just a young college kid and they let him have this car. I've been trying to get it for the last 10 years, you know. So it was a hobby. It was a competitive, you know. So, but in the end, my focus ended up on concept cars and mainly General Motors concept cars. But I've had all the concept cars of Virgil Exner. We've probably had 10 or 12 of his most important cars. I've had a Hudson Italia. I've had, you know, American Motors concept cars. And, you know, after you get older, you can't carry as much heavy luggage as you could when you were younger. So my focus now is mainly General Motors.
You know, I think it's admirable, too, that you have been so generous in sharing the collection with people. The cars have traveled all over the place to different shows and Concours events. A lot of collections stay under lock and key, but that hasn't been your approach.
No. Before the turn of the century, the cars were literally on the road a good part of the time, and we were in such museums as the Gilmore Museum for 2 years with our own building. We were the stars of the Louis Vuitton show, a great show, outdoor show in New York City. But never did I do a focused show at the Peterson Museum where the nucleus started, which was with Harley Earl, General Motors, and Motorama, the centerpiece of American post-war automotive design. And from that, all the other American manufacturers got their ideas for concept cars and design and things like that. Although Virgil Exner was a very important element in the mix, you know, a very important element. And one of the most beautiful concept cars, dream cars, call it what you want, that was ever made, in my opinion, was the 1955 Chrysler Ghia Falcon. And the pity of that car was if it came out in 1955, there's a good chance that there wouldn't be a Thunderbird as it developed. And there's a real good chance that there wouldn't be a Corvette. Corvette was always kind of, by 1955, they only made 700 Corvettes. They were in trouble. And if they would have come out with the Falcon, I think that would have snuffed out the Corvette completely. Absolutely. So just the happenstances of events happened, and they just never put the Falcon into production. And, you know, they only made two of them, and they've only found one, and that's the one that I have. So, yeah, it's a masterpiece, absolute masterpiece. But, you know, certainly there's Harley Earl has his masterpieces, but, you know, that would be my favorite, and that was Virgil Exner Sr.'s favorite design that he ever made. And it was very stylish in the early 50s to make very things very clean. And then, you know, it kind of grew with Christmas tree decorations, where by 1958, the 58 Oldsmobile and the 58 Buick were just so loaded with chrome that, you know, you just wanted to, you know, you were disgusted with it. So, you know, and then all of a sudden, 57, Virgil Exner comes in with his really clean lines, and that takes over. And then, you know, GM was doing a little catch-up work there.
Yeah, and then by the early 1960s, Harley Earl has retired in 58, mandatory retirement at age 65. And Bill Mitchell comes into the picture, and he really turns everything upside down in terms of what they had been doing. Now suddenly it's rectilinear and very clean and minimalist trim.
Well, he was definitely into foreign cars.
Right.
And foreign cars were the Achilles heel for General Motors because they got into design, but before design, they were into engineering things. And now here, I'll give you an interesting, real interesting fact. The two LaSalles have V6, aluminum block, double overhead cam, fuel-injected engine with independent rear suspension on the Roadster. This is 1955. They had that engine was in an engine stand being tested, so it wasn't fully tested where they could put it in the car and have it running in the two LaSalles.
When you say the two LaSalles, you're talking about two of the cars in your collection.
That are in the museum.
Right.
And one of them is Junkyard Fresh that's now on display at the Peterson Museum for 2 years.
No, that's very cool.
So that's
And I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to clarify. Also, another point of clarification. LaSalle was considered a sort of a lower priced Cadillac. They came in they put that into the GM lineup, I think, in the late 20s, right, Joe? There was sort of a gap in GM's lineup. In fact, Joe, why don't you explain it?
Okay. In 1929, as you well know, there was a thing called the Depression. And all of a sudden, the expensive cars were too expensive. So as you probably know, Studebaker had a smaller car. I can't remember what it was, but you probably know the name of it. I don't. And every car, Packard didn't come out with a new name for their car, but they came out with the 120, which was a very small car. And so LaSalle was just the small version of the Cadillac, so they could sell a cheaper Cadillac because the big cars weren't selling. The dealers needed something that would move. They didn't want to give them a Chevrolet. They didn't have a franchise for that, so they made a smaller car. So the LaSalle was actually one of the first cars that was designed as a compact. That was a compact car, and it was made specifically for Cadillac, and also it was made because Harley Earl's first car that he designed for General Motors was the LaSalle. So now it was kind of like his swan song. And interesting enough, to add more fuel to the fire, his dog, as I got the story from some of the General Motors guys, he loved his dogs and he was an animal lover. And his dog died. And he was so upset about it while they were designing the LaSalle. He came in one day and he was so upset that he wanted to do something to memorialize his dog. And he looked at the LaSalle emblem that was on the hood, and he told them to put a silhouette of his dog into the emblem. So on both LaSalles, there's a silhouette of a dog in the LaSalle emblem. So, you know, a little interesting tidbits.
Interesting, yeah, yeah. And so later on, flash forward to the 1950s, why did they call these show cars the LaSalle 2? Why did they resurrect that name? Was that...
The reason that I was told that they did that was this was a car that he was going to oversee 100%.
Okay.
And it was considered his swan song. So he called it LaSalle, and he didn't want to have it be part of any other division, which, you know, could put claim to it. So it wasn't really at that point seen as a Cadillac. It was seen as a LaSalle independent. And it didn't have to have anybody arguing over, hey, this is our car, you know, we're making this at Chevrolet. You don't get to make it at Pontiac.
Okay.
And that's so, yeah. So that's my understanding of why it was, and it was called Roman numeral two because he wanted to differentiate it as not being a continuation of the LaSalle that they stopped making.
After World War II, right. Incidentally, you mentioned Studebaker had a more affordably priced nameplate that they came up with as a result of the Depression. And that car was called the Rockne.
That's right.
And
yeah,
it was
right.
named after Notre Dame's football coach, Newt Rockne, Notre Dame, of course, being in South Bend, Indiana, the same city as Studebaker Corporation. By the way, I had to look that up, Joe. I did not pull that out of the memory banks because that's very obscure. But yeah, anyway, it was called the Rockne.
Well, you'll check that most of the larger cars came out with a smaller version, and it's usually a name that you don't remember because it didn't last very long.
Right. Well, Pontiac, Oakland, you know. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, there's an interesting story, you know. Pontiac was the smaller car for Oakland. And Oakland, you know, and then eventually it was so popular that it took over for Oakland, and they dropped Oakland and kept Pontiac. Interesting twist.
So funny. Well, man, Joe, you and I could probably go down all these rabbit holes for the next several hours very easily. But I just realized we kind of got on a tangent with the LaSalle. I wanted to just clarify, let people know the origin of the LaSalle nameplate. In doing so, I interrupted you because you were really telling me a story about the LaSalle 2. You mentioned the architecture and the engine, and it was an aluminum block and all that. Where were you going with that? I'd like to finish that story.
Where I was going with that is that every successful situation has a locomotive. There's something about that situation that's the driver. And at General Motors, at the proper time, the driver was styling. And engineering took the back seat. And how in the world, in 1955, all of a sudden, somebody decided to make a V6, which was, nobody was making V6s. Aluminum block, double overhead cam, fuel injected engine in 1955 is inconceivable. You know, I mean, they were just coming out with the Chevrolet V8 pushrod engine as being revolutionary. So in the 60s and 70s, the Europeans brought in their cars, their high-end sports cars, aluminum block, fuel injected, and overhead cams. Overhead cams is really what takes an engine and really makes it go fast because it really can breathe. And I always said that that was kind of the beginning of the turning point for General Motors towards the end of the century, not having anything engineering-wise that could compete with the Europeans, Mercedes. And so it became the Achilles heel for General Motors. Now, after the turn of the century, General Motors all of a sudden started to say, wait a second, yeah, we got to get into this engineering thing. And certainly with Cadillacs and a lot of the engines became very novel in terms of their engineering. And of course, today we got a Corvette that's mid-engine. So yeah, so now they've played catch up very well. But that's where we got in trouble by the end of the turn of the century. Yet they had the whole thing right there, and it just never got out of the box. So that's where I was going with it. And that's in the LaSalles. The two LaSalles have those engines on the outside fully developed. They just didn't have the insides all done. And so they had an electric motor in the back to drive it around the stage. And what we did with the LaSalle Roadster is we increased the size of the electric motor so that you can just drive it on the street like a regular car. But it is an electric car. So it's kind of an interesting hybrid that we came up with to really make it into a nice driver.
You know, I have a suspicion that someone at GM knew about Lancia's V6. Lancia was, they had the world's first production V6 in 1950. And I believe it was an aluminum block. If I had to guess, it wasn't just out of thin air. Somebody had seen a Lancia and thought, that's an interesting engine.
Now that you said that about the Lancia, I didn't recall it when we were talking, but I believe that's correct. That I think it was 1949. They came out with that V6, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's just interesting because the cross-pollination is a good...
Good word. Yes, good word. Good word, yes. But when it becomes the locomotive, that's when it should be getting the credit for the success. So that would be my take on it. And there's no question in my mind what interfered with the V6 aluminum block double overhead cam, because the LaSalle 2 was going to be a compact car, was that it became competitive with this other idea of the rear engine car, VW, and that may have be what buried the idea of this V6. So, the Corvair wasn't that successful with Ralph Nader and all that nonsense. But my dad had a 60 Corvair, brand new in 60, and we used to drive it back into snowbanks, and then you'd pull right out because you got all that weight sitting right on the wheels. You know, it's equivalent to front wheel drive, you know.
Exactly. Another fascinating car to me is the 1956 Cadillac Valkyrie. It's a very unusual design, and it's a Brooks Stevens design, in fact.
Right. I don't recall that I ever met Brooks Stevens, but he had a little museum up in Wisconsin. And when he passed away, I went up there and they were selling off some cars. And I thought it was a pretty interesting design. And I wouldn't consider it a
beautiful design,
a great sculpture. And then everybody would say that the front bumper looked like a piece off a steam engine, you know, that would clear the tracks, you know.
A cow catcher.
Or a snow plow or something.
Well, Brooks Stevens was kind of the same generation as Raymond Loewy. And he was also a very prolific industrial designer. He did everything from train cars to, I think, kitchen appliances, automobiles.
Yeah, they call him an industrial designer is what they call him.
Right. He's the guy that was responsible for the 1963 Jeep Wagoneer, which lasted a design that lasted like 30 years. I think he did the Studebaker Lark station wagon with the sliding roof.
Right. I think you're right. Yeah.
A number of really fascinating designs. But so this Cadillac is, I'll have to put a picture up on my Instagram so that people can see it, because it's almost defies description, but it's got this, as you say, this crazy V-shaped front bumper, this massive chrome piece.
They made two of those cars, and I had one, and the other one still exists. My car had the removable hard top, but it did not have a soft top. I think the other one has a soft top with the removable hard top. The other story with that car is that when he took it out of the showbiz, he gave it to his wife. And his wife, as I understand it, was about 4'10". It was way too big for her, so she never put any miles on it. And then he put it in his museum. And then we had it. And I could never really get myself wrapped around that car for the design. It just didn't grab me. You know, it was one of those cars that I bought anything that was concept cars. So, yeah.
So another one of your cars that's really fascinating to me is the 1964 Pontiac Banshee, otherwise known as Project XP833.
Yeah, that car was in the hands of Bill Collins, who was a designer at the same time as DeLorean.
John DeLorean, yeah, who was at Pontiac.
And, yeah, DeLorean was kind of the guy that was running Pontiac. He considered himself a designer. And him and Bill Collins were great friends. And he understood design from the sales point of view, DeLorean. So he would do little features, on the cars and make them look European, and they'd sell great. So he wanted to come out with his version of a sports car. So he went to General Motors top brass, and he said, I got this drawing here, and it's 90-inch wheelbase, and it's going to have all sorts of novelty things on it. He made the clutch brake pedals swing, so you didn't have to move the seat. You'd move the pedals, you know. They have that on Lincolns now, I think. Here it was back in 64. And they said, listen, Corvette is just taking off. We don't have to compete with ourselves. You have a red light on that? No. So he went back to Pontiac. He walled off part of the area there in design, and he built the Banshee Roadster. And then he went back to them, and he said, you know, I've been a bad boy, but I have to show you what I did. So he had a whole catalog brochure showing the Banshee and its size, and he had it competitive with the Mustang. The Mustang's got a back seat in it. It's not a sports car. And they said, listen, you know, we're not stupid. That's not competitive with the Mustang. It's competitive, again, with our Corvette. You can't build it. So then he went back and he did a version of it with a six-cylinder engine in a hardtop version. And he went back to him and he said, this garbage, Dad. You just crush it. We don't want it around. So DeLorean, he didn't care what they did with it. He was getting ready to do his thing over in Ireland. And eventually he took Bill Collins with him, you know, to Ireland. But Bill, they had the car stored in a trailer behind Pontiac. And Bill wanted that Banshee Roadster. He didn't care about the six-cylinder one. And he eventually convinced somebody at the top there to give him the car and keep it quiet. And he had it. So I went to try and buy it from him. He says, Joe, I'm never going to sell this car. I'm leaving it to my family. So if you're calling me to be friendly and I love talking to you, you're wasting your time. Don't call me. And if you want to talk to me, you know, go ahead and talk to me, but don't be doing it because you think you're going to get the Banshee. So I stopped calling him a lot. You know, my calls diminished quite a bit.
Yeah, because you like talking to him, but you really wanted the car.
Well, yeah, you know, but it was a motive. So eventually I didn't talk to him for a year or two, and I get a call. Joe, do you want to buy the Banshee? Well, yeah, Bill, I told you that a long time ago. Okay. I said, what do you want for it? He gave me a price. I said, no problem. He said, when do you want to come up here and close the deal? And I said, well, let's see. Maybe in about 3 weeks I can come up there. Oh, you know, forget the whole thing. I said, what happened? He said, if you want to come up here, you'd come up here right away. So I said, okay, well, this weekend I'll come up. He says, no, just forget the whole thing. I said, what happened? He said, if you wanted that car the way you always said you wanted it so bad, you'd be up here tomorrow morning. I says, well, I got a meeting with a board in a village for a new liquor license for one of our restaurants. And it's at 8 o'clock. And if you wanted me up there in the morning, I'd have to go from that meeting and drive all the way up to your house to be up there in the morning. He says, yeah. He says, what do you want for breakfast? So I says, okay. So I went to the meeting. I drove all night, didn't sleep, got there at, I don't know, 7 in the morning. And he lived up on a big hill, and there was like a valley down below with a river running there. I can't remember. This is 30 years ago. And I never eat breakfast. I mean, breakfast used to make me sick. So I would, you know, just have a little something to drink and wait for lunch, you know, orange juice or something. So his wife makes me a plate, and it's got pork sausage, bacon, eggs, scrambled eggs, poached eggs, all on my plate. So, you know, so I'm sitting there trying to pretend like I'm eating a little of this. He, well, when are we going to look at the car? He goes, yeah, as soon as you finish your plate. I said, well, that's like a little kid, you know, you got to finish your plate. And this was his personality. So finally, you know, I kind of ate enough that he said, okay, so let's go look at the car. And we go out. In the back of his house, he had a garage that was the width of his house, and it was mostly empty. And I'm looking around. I go, where's the Banshee? He says, it's over there in the corner under all those covers. And it was like piled up with stuff on top of it and stuff. And I would have thought that he'd come in to see the car. He would have at least made it easy to see. So we go over there, and we take off the covers. He says, so what do you want to do now? I said, well, I want to buy it. You know, and really, we put all the covers on the from the front onto the back. So I really didn't see the car. I just saw the front end of it. So, you know, I was saying to him, like, can we take the covers off? And it was like, well, here, let's just go in and we'll go in the dining room. If you want to buy it, we'll just make the deal. I said, oh, okay. So we go in there and I write him a check and this and that. And then, you know, I learned a long time ago, you never push guys that have cars and start to say, well, listen, you know, you're being unreasonable about something. They say, you know what? Just forget the whole deal, go home. And I've had that happen. So I'm being very low key. So finally, after all this, I give him the check and signs over the title and all that. And I'm going, is it okay if we take the stuff off the back of the car now and take a good look at it? He goes, it's your car. What are you asking me for? You know, it's like whatever I'd say, you know, it was wrong. You know. So we went and I looked at the car. And I was so excited.
So, Joe, the car was in good shape. It wasn't like you bought a pig in a poke.
No. It was okay. Gorgeous. Right. It was in beautiful shape. In the end, we did repaint it. Some of the paint was cracking and stuff, and we got the original color repainted, but the rest of the car is 100% original. And I had known that he had started this Vixen motorhome thing, and he says, come on, I'll take you over there, and I'll show you this factory. Well, I went in, I realized the factory looked like it was out of business. Later, I found out that the reason he wanted to get the car sold so quickly was that the car was titled in the Vixen motorhome. And he was apparently going to go out of bankruptcy, and
he didn't want it seized.
Yeah, so we had to make the deal before it got caught up in the bankruptcy.
I see.
So that was the story there. But he was a character. He was really a sweet guy. He kind of talked in a rough manner
to play with people a little bit, right? Like maybe play.
I don't know. I don't think he was really doing it intentionally. I think his nature was defensive. I think he was really a soft guy that defended himself by acting, you know, hard on the outside, so people wouldn't think that they could push him around. And he was a real gentleman, and we became great friends.
I need to just describe a couple of elements about the Pontiac Banshee, just so people understand. It's quite significant. Number one, it looks like a 1968 Corvette. Okay, it's got that swoopy, fish-like, some would say shark-like styling, and the rear end, the taillights are those really thin lamps that became an element of the first gen Pontiac Trans Am.
Oh yeah. Well, DeLorean was a great designer of styling cues.
Right.
He wasn't a designer of the whole car. He just could take, hey, let's do this. Let's put this on that. And I think he had a lot of help from Bill Collins for the overall design. When it comes to automotive design, it does reflect on society and where they are in their thoughts with materials and colors and how that reflects in their homes and their buildings that they build and things like that. So that's an element of design that somebody could do a college thesis on by taking automotive design and seeing how it ties in with history of other things that have nothing to do really with the essence of cars, you know.
I agree with everything you just said, and I just think it's fascinating that some of these elements that you see in these show cars, dream cars, concept cars, whatever you want to call them, the total design doesn't survive very long. It was a seasonal thing to showcase the manufacturer, but elements of those cars survived into production. So that's really cool.
Yeah, that's a styling cues, you know. But here, take the Bonneville Special. It's kind of the reverse. The Bonneville Special is all jet design, reflecting what was going on in society with the novelty of jet planes. So the back end of it looks like a jet plane. The canopy looks like a jet plane. The canopy opens up like a jet plane, and so on and so forth. So there's all these elements that get intertwined that really make things more interesting than you realize. So these styling cues get into production. Sometimes you don't realize it, you know, but they're there. So it's a fun place to be with concept cars because they offer so much to talk about and think about,
right,
you know. And they're such a beautiful eye candy that you know, you can enjoy them in so many multiple ways, you know. And you're so knowledgeable. You're the most knowledgeable person that I've ever met, maybe other than myself. I mean, seriously, most people don't have all the – I can't get into these discussions with them because they don't have all these reference points to quite understand, you know, some of my points that I make. But you're really, you know, very well versed in this.
You're embarrassing me. No, I do appreciate that. And there are so many people who have forgotten more than I will ever know about this stuff, Joe. But I really love it. I care about it. And I love the history and people behind it. And so I've done a lot of podcasts and, you know, there, yes, I guess I do know a lot about it, but it's fun to talk to somebody else who's fluent in this stuff, if you will. So, well, listen, I have really enjoyed talking to you, and on behalf of car lovers everywhere, thank you for saving these cars. They're incredible, and I cannot wait to see the exhibit. It's called GM's Marvelous Motorama, Dream Cars from the Joe Bortz Collection. And it opens March 16th at the Peterson Museum in Los Angeles. Joe Bortz, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, I want you to know the pleasure has been all mine. And I think that your audience is very lucky to have you in general be so knowledgeable. I hope you're as knowledgeable on all subjects as you are on this, because you certainly are quite an interesting guy. And I hope that maybe we can come back again after the show opens up. And there is a secret element that we're trying to add to the show that I can't discuss right now. So if that does come about, I'm sure we'll hopefully have another opportunity to expand on that.
Joe, you are welcome anytime, my friend, and it's been a real pleasure. So can't wait for the cars to be here in LA. Can't wait to see it.
That's all for this episode of Horsepower Heritage. If you like what you heard, go to buymeacoffee.com/HP Heritage and throw a few bucks in the gas tank. Leave me 5 stars and a quick review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and tell your friends about the show. I'll see you back here on Wednesday, March 27th, for more of the people and stories behind the machines. So until then, I'm Maurice Merrick. Thanks for listening.